And so I'm going to answer your question by giving you what's the difference between the God of Islam and the God of Christianity. And maybe I'll also throw in the God of Judaism. So you got these three different gods. And what's interesting about that collection of gods is that all of them have the Old Testament as part of their holy writ. I mean, Judaism has the Old Testament. Islam endorses virtually the entirety of the Old Testament as part of their inspired scripture, as does Christianity, and for that matter, so does Mormonism. They accept the Old Testament. Now, what's different is the Jews reject the New Testament. Muslims and Mormons accept both the Old Testament and the New Testament, but they add another piece of holy writ on top of that. In the case of Mormonism, they have three additional books, the Pearl of Great Price, the Book of Mormon, and Doctrines and Covenants. And in the case of Islam, they have the Quran. Now, in terms of what the Quran reveals about God, it basically endorses the Christian doctrine of a transcendent God. But what they reject is the doctrine of an immanent God. Christianity talks about God being both immanent and transcendent. Now, those are theological technical terms. I'll define them for you. The transcendence of God is this concept that God is completely beyond our realm of matter, energy, space, and time, and that he can operate with freedom beyond matter, energy, space, and time. And the God of Islam is that kind of God. He's outside and free to operate independent of our reality of matter, energy, space, and time. The immanence of God is best described by a verse in Jeremiah that says God fills the entirety of his creation, which means no matter where you go in the universe, according to the Bible, God is there. He's at every point of space and at every moment of time. And there's nowhere you can go in all of the physical creation where God is not present. He's everywhere. Or to put it another way, Christianity talks about the omnipresence of the Creator. And whereas Islam talks about God being completely outside. And so this is why you hear people comparing the God of Islam to the God of Christianity, where the Islamic God is a distant God. Rather than entering into a realm, he remains outside the realm. And it's a God that Muslims struggle to reach. So it's not the kind of God that you can have an intimate day-to-day relationship with. It's a God that's distant and far. And a God that is holy in the sense that they see this God as completely beyond human capability to reach. Where I think the Christian God offers some hope for humanity, it's a God that fills a realm and has actually entered into a realm. The message of the New Testament is how the Creator of the universe transcends space and time and created space and time, entered our space and time, lowered himself, gave us an example of how we can humble ourselves as he humbled himself, and how we can come into a personal, loving relationship with that Creator by admitting that we're not perfect, that God's standard is one of perfection, and he makes the offer of trading his moral perfection for a moral imperfection. Whereas what you see in Islam is a God that is morally perfect, and a system of works whereby human beings try to measure up to God's standard, and they measure up, they get into heaven, and if they don't, they don't get into heaven. Mormonism is a little bit different. You know, in Islam, you actually do have a hell where people who have failed to meet God's standard wind up suffering for the rest of eternity. In Mormonism, everybody goes to heaven. But there's three different levels of heaven. So there's the A level, the B level, and the C level. But nobody winds up getting condemned. And so in that sense, the better your good works are, the higher the level that you get to go to. Likewise, Islam is based on this concept that if you do sufficient good works, you can make it to that top level. Now, I've been to a number of Islamic nations over the years, and the question I like to ask these Islamic leaders is, well, how good is good enough? And the thing I've noticed every time I've dealt with these is that at no point do they recognize that they've achieved enough to qualify. So what's difficult about Islam compared to Christianity, there's no way or pathway whereas in this life, you can get a guarantee of your entry into eternity and the eternal reward that exists there. Now, there's also great differences on the level of the reward. Now, I meant to say something about Judaism. By the way, I've got nothing against the Jewish scriptures. My complaint is what Jewish theologians have done with the Jewish scriptures. And particularly here in America, the problem is that most what I would call fervent Orthodox Jews that you meet really don't follow or study the entirety of what they call the Tanakh. That's their word for the Old Testament. Now, over in Europe and parts of Africa and Asia, you do get Jews who actually seriously entertain the entirety of the Old Testament. But here in America, it's much more common to run into Jews for whom their Bible would be the first five books, the books written by Moses, Psalms, Proverbs, and that's probably where it ends. And some only accept the five books of Moses and really don't pay much attention beyond that. And what I've seen them do is that they, you know, like Islam and Mormonism, will deny that God is triune. They deny that God predestinates and simultaneously offers us free choice. And incidentally, that's another thing about Islam. Islam believes in the doctrine of predestination, where God controls and predestinates everything from before the beginning of the universe. Christianity teaches that as well. But where Christianity differs is it says, in the same manner that God predestinates every thought I think, every word I'll speak, every action I'll perform, He also grants to me the freedom to choose my thoughts, my words, and my actions. And the Bible declares that that's not a contradiction. Now, I've written a book called Beyond the Cosmos. I think it's over there on the table, where I make the point it is a contradiction if you insist that God can only operate in length with place and time. But if we allow God to be simultaneously immanent and transcendent, I mathematically show you how you can resolve the paradox of divine predestination and human free choice. And for that matter, how you can resolve the paradox of God being three and one at the same time, three persons and one essence. But one of the things I've noticed is every religion outside of Christianity denies the Trinity, and they deny the simultaneity of free will and predestination. Also, they deny the simultaneous immanence and transcendence of the Creator. And incidentally, that's one of the reasons why, as a young man, I became a Christian, is recognizing that if human beings invent a religion, they're going to put God in a human box. But a religion that's truly from the Creator of the universe, that transcends matter, energy, space, and time, we should expect that that revelation will contain teachings or doctrines that defy our human capacity to visualize what God could be like. A Trinity is not something that a human being would ever invent about God, because it's something you can't put into a box of length, width, height, and time. But the simultaneity of free will and predestination, for example, is usually resolved in three independent dimensions of time. If you want to see how it works, you can check out the book. I don't know if that's enough of a background. That's good enough? Okay, all right.
Geez, that was an incredibly long answer to this question. I hope I can remember what you started out talking about. And I may or may not have understood. But Carl Sagan, 20, 25 years ago or so, had a program called Cosmos.
Right.
And one of the episodes of Cosmos was trying to describe the evolutionary sequence from the first one-cell organism, right, to Homo sapiens sapiens. And it went through, you know, different stages. There was a blue-green algae, and finally up to Cicadont and Archaeopteryx. Okay. Now, in that evolutionary sequence purported to explain how we came about over many stages, starting from one cell organism. Now, were you saying in the beginning that life could not form over a long period of time, but had to be quick?
Right.
And if so, then are you saying that Carl, whom you studied under, that episode is incorrect?
That's correct.
That's new information to me. So if Carl were alive today, he would produce a different episode?
I think he would. He'd be forced to. I mean, My colleague, Fazal Rana, our staff biochemist, and I attended two of the major Origin of Life conferences. These are worldwide conferences. And as far back as 1996, there was a consensus amongst Origin of Life researchers that indeed, in terms of planet Earth, there's no time and there's no soup. And that has never been questioned since 1996. The evidence really is overwhelming that there's virtually no time and certainly no soup, which is really why so much of our book focuses on the speculation that it took place in outer space.
And it gets us in quickly. Well, then, you know, Harold Urey and Stanley Miller did these experiments long ago where they actually put in a glass flask the primordial gases of hydrogen, water vapor, methane. And by energizing that with either ultraviolet light or an electric spark, they eventually found a residue inside the flask. And they examined the residue, and in there were some amino acids.
Yeah, they found one amino acid, glycine.
But only one?
Okay. Yeah, just the one.
But the notion then that people thought might be an explanation for how life evolved is that if you could have that process taking place on the Earth somewhere, and over time, those molecules begin to link up and become more complex. Eventually, there would come that instant in time when the first molecule formed that could replicate itself.
Right.
And that's that is a definition for life. Are you also saying that was also an unlikely pathway to life?
There's now a consensus that that couldn't possibly have happened.
Okay.
Now, the thing about the Urey-Miller experiment is that it was presumed at the time that that fairly represented the primordial conditions of planet Earth. We now have been able to dig into the past chemistry of the planet and realize Earth never had those conditions. So in that sense, the Urey-Miller experiment is completely irrelevant to the origin of life. In the 1996, in fact, this goes back to 1986, Origin of Life conference, it was revealed by certain physicists that at the time of life's origins on planet Earth, there was about 1% oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. And several of the chemists jumped up and said, that can't be. Oxygen's toxic to Origin of Life chemistry. Isn't there some scenario you can work out where we wouldn't have this deadly oxygen? And the physicists got up and said, well, we don't like it either, but that's what the evidence tells us. There's oxygen there. It's not hydrogen-rich. It's either neutral or oxygen-rich, and it looks like it's oxygen-rich. And at the 1999 Origin of Life Research Conference, a Romanian physicist got up and said, it doesn't matter. If you've got oxygen, that's going to stop the origin of life chemistry. If you don't have oxygen, then ultraviolet radiation flows through the Earth's atmosphere, and that ultraviolet radiation will stop the origin of life chemistry. And that's what's referred to in the scientific literature as what they call the oxygen-UV paradox. If you've got oxygen, it can't happen. If you don't have oxygen, it can't happen. So it's lose-lose both ways. And then finally, the Romanian physicist came up and said, we now know what the answer is. It's oxygen. And the reason why it must be oxygen is that the planet Earth, of all the solar system bodies, planet Earth has the richest abundance of uranium and thorium. And there's so much uranium and thorium in the Earth that the radioactive decay of those isotopes sends energy through the Earth's oceans. And as that energy goes through the Earth's oceans, it fractionates a small amount of the water into hydrogen and oxygen. And so the Earth's oceans become oxygenated, and likewise the atmosphere above, to about a 1% level. And, you know, 4 billion years ago, there was much more uranium and thorium in the crust of the Earth than there is today. And therefore, at no point would you not have oxygen present in the Earth's environment. And again, this is what's fueling all this speculation that must have happened in outer space and been transported to the Earth. Because everything we see about the Earth tells us it can't happen from a naturalistic perspective.
Okay. Thanks. I'll get back in line later.
First of all, thank you. I'm new to this, and it's really a special opportunity to get to talk to somebody who has a background like you do. I have so many questions, but one question I want to start off with, and then we'll see who else has questions, is I've read Rare Earth, and I've read other books by Brown and Lord. Now, I don't have the academic background to judge whether they're right or wrong. The argument seems cohesive. So I can accept the proposition that we will find abundant microbiotic life in the universe, and that anything above that, 3 or 4 cells, to intelligence would be extremely rare. Rare doesn't mean impossible. My question to you is, I don't believe in UFOs either, but if tomorrow we receive evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, however it came, that there was intelligent life, by that I mean at least our equals, not superior, would that contradict Christianity? Would it not contradict Christianity? Would it have no effect on Christianity?
Okay, good question. And 3 astronomers at Reasons to Believe, myself, Guillermo Gonzalez, and Sam Connor from MIT, several years ago wrote an article. And each of us defended 3 different positions on that issue from an evangelical Christian perspective. And the reason why we wrote that article is to make the point that from a Christian perspective, there's quite a bit of freedom on which positions you can take. But from a non-theistic perspective, you really don't have freedom. You know, in order to defend a non-theistic interpretation, you got to have the extraterrestrials out there. From a Christian perspective, you could have them or you could not have them. Now, let me give you a defense of the 3 different positions. Guillermo Gonzalez talked about the position whereby, this was from Sam Connor, that God enjoys creating. He read the Bible and says that God seems to enjoy creating so much, he's not going to stop. And so why would he stop with creating just on planet Earth? And his whole point is, he sees an apologetic value for this too. He says, if the skeptics aren't convinced by all the evidence they see on planet Earth, finding a second or a third example where you get the same set of miracles taking place on those planets that took place on planet Earth might persuade them. So he says, from that perspective, I think God would create life on another planet. Now, of course, he'd have to supernaturally design that planet in order to take the life. And Sam Connor's point is that if people see 2 supernaturally designed planets, that might persuade them. And then I took the position that God's only done it once. And the reason why I took that position is looking at the different purposes that God has for creating the universe. And one of the purposes that jumps out of the Bible for me is that he creates the universe to set up the ideal stage for a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. And the question I would ask is, how many intelligent, spiritual life species does God need to bring about that ultimate and final conquest of evil? And from what I can tell, he only needs 1. And the thing I noticed in my reading of the New Testament is that when Jesus of Nazareth was here on earth, he never performed any more miracles than was absolutely necessary to achieve his purpose. So I take the theological perspective, God's not going to waste his miraculous intervention. Every one of them must serve some ultimate purpose that's his purpose rather than our purpose. And therefore, I defended the position that God has only done it once, that he only needs to do it once. However, I agree with Sam that God really enjoys creating, and he's almost compulsively creative. But my interpretation of the last 3 chapters of the Bible is that God's got a new creation coming. And he's taking this moment where he rests from his creation work. I believe we're in the 7th creation day. But Revelation 21 speaks about the 8th day of creation. And God's going to create in that 8th day like he's never created in the first 6. And therefore, I see plenty of room for God to express his creativity far beyond what he has done here. And for that matter, I wouldn't put it past God that maybe he's got 1,000,000 creation weeks on his calendar. We're in the first. The second one has been revealed to us in the last 2 chapters of the Bible, but there could be a whole lot more in store than he hasn't yet bothered to reveal to us. So in that sense, I think I can agree with Sam that God is indeed almost compulsively creative. Then Guillermo Gonzalez, he's now at Iowa State University, took the position in between. He says, God wants to impress the skeptic. He doesn't have to make intelligent life on another planet. All he's got to do is put grass on another planet. Or he could put fish on another planet. and therefore he defended the position that God indeed has created life elsewhere, but not at the level that we're at. And so he agreed with me that God would only create one intelligent species of life, because that's all he really needs to bring about the conquest of evil. But our whole point was, these are three very different positions, coming from three astronomers that are all part of the Reasons to Believe team, and we don't look at these differences as being a significant impact on what we believe about the Bible. In fact, all of us ended up the article saying that we would be quite pleased if we were proven wrong, and one of our colleagues was proven right. But our whole point is, if you don't believe in God, what other hope do you have other than what Carl Sagan expressed? Again, I'll go back to this course I took. One of the last lectures he gave in the course is he kind of reviewed for us all the gloom and doom that the human species is facing. We could wipe ourselves out with nuclear war. There could be a new influenza that would kill us all off. There could be a cancer that we can't beat back. We could wind up polluting the planet so we can't live here anymore. All these nasty things. And he said, what hope do we have as human beings other than the fact that maybe we can make contact with some extraterrestrial intelligent civilization that's more advanced than us and has solved all these problems and has written a book and is broadcasting that book through other states. Now, here I was sitting in this audience of astronomy professors and astronomy graduate students at the University of Toronto. I suspect I was the only believer in the Christian faith there, but I remember nudging one of my friends with my elbow and saying, don't we already have this book? And isn't Carl's problem the fact that he won't read this book that we have gotten from an extraterrestrial being beyond space and time? So, matter of fact, we got to talk to Carl about that. And he says, well, the problem I have with your Encyclopedia Galactica, namely the Holy Bible, is that it speaks about a morality that I find repugnant. And so, whereas, you know, my coming to Christ was reading the Bible and saying, here's a morality that I think is really elegant and beautiful, and I want to do everything I can to follow that morality. On the other hand, I discovered exactly the same thing Carl did. If you try to live up to the morality of the Bible, you're going to discover just how immoral you really are. But I think the message of the Bible is, God gave us this law to prove to us we can't live up to His standards, but He's prepared to do it for us if only we ask. And Carl, at that point, wasn't really that.
Thank you. Just I recall having a child reading a science fiction story where this scientist was traveling the universe trying to find Jesus. He was finding a planet just after Jesus left. He would go planet to planet to planet. He'd get there just in time, one day too late.
Well, there's one little comment I can make on that, and this is something that Guillermo and Sam and I put in this article, is that maybe God has created life elsewhere, but He's not created intelligent life that's spiritual in nature and is in need of redemption. Because what we see in Hebrews 9 and 10 is Jesus Christ came one place, one time, for all. And so that would seem to preclude the idea that he's hopping from planet to planet to planet, getting himself crucified and cross after cross after cross, because he did it one time for all. And so that will not necessarily mitigate against dolphins on planet X, but I think it would mitigate against the idea that there's a species like ours that is spiritual in nature and in need of redemption.
Excellent. I have a question about restoration theory.
What kind of theory?
Restoration.
Restoration theory, okay.
Because you said that there is only, we believe there is a second creation, but now most systematic theology is if you have any Bible references or something, because I talked to somebody, he said there is a Bible where everywhere it says recreated, restored, or something like that. There is a special translation of Bible,
Okay. He's asked me to comment on what's called restoration theology, which is very popular on Christian television these days. And I've got a book that's in our editorial office right now that Rudy talks about the 12 different purposes for God creating the universe. But part of that is to refute this notion of restoration theology. What restoration theology says is that Christians are on the planet today and they're winning the war against secular society. And eventually Christians will take over society and run it according to God's principles and will restore heaven here on earth. And so in restoration theology, the universe is eternal. The earth is eternal. And so they believe in a renewed earth rather than a new earth, and a renewed universe rather than a new universe. Now, what I have argued, and you'll find some of this in Creation of Science, and especially Beyond the Cosmos, you want to see something that's already in print, that God's intent for human beings is to be ushered into a realm where there aren't the dimensional restrictions that prevent us from experiencing the intimacy in relationships that God intends. In other words, Adam and Eve had a situation that's considerably inferior in the Garden of Eden to what God promises to his people who receive his offer of redemption. And in the new creation, we're not going to be bound by length, width, height, and time. Nor will we be bound by gravity or thermodynamics or electromagnetism. In fact, Revelation 21 explicitly states that there will be no law of gravity. There won't be thermodynamics. Things won't decay. We're not going to have this flow of energy running from hot bodies to cold bodies. Neither will we have electromagnetic light. That the light we have in the new creation will operate in such a way that there will never be darkness and there will never be shadows. Everything will glow with light. And it's going to be light not associated with heat. And also talks about how we're going to be able to geometrically relate to one another. And to me, this is one of the great promises of the new creation, is that in this creation, because of the evil that's around us, God has chosen to confine us to a single dimension of time where time cannot be stopped or reversed, which means I can only relate to one individual at a time at any degree of intimacy. I mean, the truth of the matter is I'm relating to, what, about 40 of you right now. But it's not really at any kind of great level of intimacy. That's just kind of a general conversation that's going on here. If you really want to have an intimate relationship with someone, it means saying no to every human being on planet Earth. So, for example, I have an appointment calendar where I agree to meet with just one person. And we can have an intense relationship with one another because nobody else is involved. And this is what marriage is all about. You know, when I marry people at the altar, I'm basically saying to the woman, today you're saying no to every human being on planet Earth except this man. And I say to the man, today you're committing yourself to say no to every other human being on planet Earth except this one woman. And it's the only way you're going to be able to enjoy the intimacy that God intends because of the fact of your space-time limitation. But the wonderful thing about the new creation, that if you're going to be able to take simultaneous private appointments with as many millions of people as you want. And for example, none of you have to wait in line to have a private appointment with the Apostle Paul. If you want to talk with the Apostle Paul, you can talk to him one-on-one, but a million other people can do the same thing at the same time. Geometric time allows you to do that. Now, I don't know what kind of brain we're going to have that's going to enable us to have all those kinds of simultaneous communications going on, but I can't understand why God doesn't give that to us now. If he gave it to us right now, we would abuse it for evil purposes. Or at least there'd be evil people out there that would do it to simultaneously perpetrate evil on millions of people at the same time. Now, think about the terrorist situation we're facing today. What if they could do terrorism in two dimensions of time? We'd be in real trouble. Because these are evil times, God says we're not going to let that happen. We're going to use the physics and the space-time dimensions of the universe to keep evil in check. So when evil is gone, there's no longer any need for those checks in physics and dimensionality, and God will set us free. Which is my big complaint against restoration theology, is that it promises a heaven that's much more limited than the promises I see in the Bible. And as far as all those verses that talk about God restoring all things, it does not mean that he restores them permanently. I mean, for example, I've heard one famous restoration theologian quote from Psalm 147 and 148 about how the stars will burn forever and how God's going to restore the natural condition. However, he fails to recognize that in the Hebrew language, there's no single word that means takes on the one definition of eternity. Rather, they got this word olam that could mean eternity, but it could simply mean a long period of time. So it says, for example, the Aaronic priesthood, that it will last olam, which could be forever, or it could be just 10 or 20 generations, or something in between. The Aaronic priesthood has been long gone for a couple of thousand years, and so it did not last for all of eternity. Now, in the New Testament, they actually do have a Greek word that means eternity and nothing else. And those are the verses that promise that we'll be in the new creation for all of eternity, not just a very long period of time. And by the way, this is another classic example where people pick up one verse and ignore the rest of what Scripture says. What you'll see in our book, A Matter of Days, where I critique the restoration theology of the younger creationist movement, is here you've got Henry Morris quoting this one verse out of Psalm 147, but he ignores 11 verses elsewhere in the Old Testament that tell us the stars will disappear, they will vanish, they'll go up in smoke, they will be no more, and God's going to make everything brand new. So we're going to develop a doctrine. We at least need to put it in the context of everything the Bible's got to say. The thing I like about the Bible, it's got 25 creation accounts. The Quran has 3, 2 of which are copies from the Bible, one of which is original to the Quran. But every other holy book has only 1 or 2. The Bible is 25, which means we can critique and test our interpretations of creation by cross-checking all these different creation accounts to see what they've got to say. Okay.
Dr. Ross, I'm trying to understand this 14 or 15 billion years age of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even understand what billion years is, but can you tell me what's your most recent publication that explains a few of the ways that astronomers use to estimate the age of the universe? I know you've done it in your earlier books, but I want to know if there's an update that where the astronomers have zeroed in on it.
Yes. The book you want to get is called A Matter of Days, and I'm pretty sure it's over there at the table. That came out in June of 2004, and at that point they had the WMAT measurement at 13.7 billion years. The book that's now in our editorial department actually shows that we now know the age of the universe to 4 places of the decimal, so 13.73. Although it looks like a tiny upward adjustment might come to that date from a research team here in Pasadena headed up by Alan Sanders. Turns out there was a calibration problem in that 13.73, so that might be adjusted. It's going to be adjusted upward very slightly. But in terms of our measuring errors, it's now down to 4 places of the decimal. You see how many different methods we have for measuring the age of the universe? There's over a dozen independent methods. Probably the easiest methods for lay people to get their handle on is that we can look far away with our telescopes, and what we notice when we look far away is that galaxies are closer together. We also notice that the galaxies are smaller, and they also have a younger appearance. They have the appearance or the colors of young burning stars, whereas galaxies up close or far apart, they're bigger, and they have the appearance of stars that have been burning for billions of years. For example, the color of newborn stars would be a deep red, a green, or a blue. And the color of stars that have been burning for a long time would be yellow. If you look at galaxies up close, they mostly look yellow. If you look at galaxies far away, they have these different colors. And the reason why they're smaller, because the picture is this. You got the universe being created from a Big Bang creation event, say 14 billion years ago. The universe starts off infinitesimally small. And over those 14 billion years, the universe gets bigger and bigger and bigger, which means the galaxies get farther and farther apart. So one of the easy ways of measuring the age of the universe is to keep looking back in time, and you look back in time by looking far away, and it takes like time to travel to you. And what you notice is the farther away you look, the more crowded together are the galaxies. So it actually shows you the universe getting smaller and smaller as you look farther and farther away and farther back in time. And the way galaxies form, the stars form first, and the stars form clusters, and the star clusters merge together to form mini-galaxies, and the mini-galaxies merge together to form medium-sized galaxies, and later the big galaxies. And again, as you look far away, you see that the galaxies are small. You can actually see this merging history flow out as you look farther and farther away, hence farther and farther back in time. Another way you can get a handle on it that doesn't take complex physics is that you look far away and you measure the temperature of the radiation left over from the creation event. And again, in the Big Bang creation model, the universe starts off infinitely hot as it expands to cool. There's a verse in Jeremiah 33 that says, the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. And this is something that physicists and astronomers have confirmed. We live in a universe with constant laws of physics, constant to at least 12 places of the decimal. And under constant physics, as the universe expands, it must get colder. It's the same principle by which your car engine works. Now, if you've got a piston engine, how that engine works is when the piston chamber is large, you have a cool gas mixture. And when the piston compresses, you get a hot gas mixture. And that's just simply a principle that flows out of thermodynamics. The bigger the volume, the colder the temperature. The smaller the volume, the hotter the temperature. Everything else is fixed. And so as we look far away, we can actually see that the universe is hotter and hotter and hotter as we look back in time. And it's hotter and hotter and hotter in exactly the way you would expect from a universe that started off with infinite temperature 14 billion years ago. Now, those are not the most conclusive proofs that we live in a 14 billion year old universe, but they're the easiest proofs for lay people to understand. I mean, there's virtually no assumptions involved in those kinds of observations. Okay, so if you want the really good ones, they're in the book. Do I have to guess the question, though?
The first one is Matthew 16:28. Verily I say unto you, there be standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Mark 9:1. And he said unto them, verily I say unto you, that there be some of them that stand here which shall not taste of death till they have seen the kingdom of God come with power. And the last one is Luke 9:27. But I tell you of a truth, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the kingdom of God.
I can guess the question.
Can you answer it?
Oh, sure. Those three passages all answer the question. Now, if you read in each of those three passages, or about anywhere from half a chapter to a full chapter later, what you'll see described is the account of the Transfiguration. Now, Jesus was speaking to just his disciples when he made those comments. And then he took three of those disciples up to the top of Mount Hermon, about a 10,000-foot high peak. And when they reached the top of Mount Hermon, Jesus was transfigured right in front of those three disciples. And so they got to see Jesus in his full glory on top of the Mount of Transfiguration. And so there were three disciples that indeed did not die before they saw Jesus in his full glory. But it was temporary.
So he's talking about the transformation.
He's talking about the transfiguration. And it was only revealed to three of his disciples. Now, the three most significant disciples, nonetheless. And it was temporary. We're talking just a few minutes on top of Mount Hermon that they saw Jesus in his full glory. And then he quickly toned down the rheostat and they went down the mountain.
Is the transformation in the three books, in the three Gospels? Or
you'll find it.
In the three of the Gospels.
Yeah, you read on a few verses, and you'll see a little account called the Transfiguration.
Okay, that kind of answers the question. Yeah.
Okay, I just finished a book on mass extinction. Peter Ward wrote the book.
Right.
It was my vacation reading. He talked about the permanent Triassic extinction, the Cretaceous, Cretaceous extinction, and then who argued that we're currently in extinction, mass extinction, everyone agree with him.
Right.
Regardless of whether you agree with how he described the extinction, you believe the extinction is something God did purposely, or did they just happen because, you say, well, he argues that the Permian Triassic extinction was a depletion of oxygen in the atmosphere, although I've read they found a meteor crater inside the South Pole with me.
Right.
I think we agree that the Cretaceous Tertiary extinction was a massive comet or whatever. Regardless of how it happened, did God do this on purpose, or did it just happen because a comet wandered too close to the Earth?
This is something we explain in quite a bit of detail in my latest book, Creationist Science. And the answer to your question is yes. We believe God did it on purpose. And what's missing in the evolutionary paradigm is a failure to recognize that the fossil record we see on planet Earth is not possible if you've got mindless evolution driving the evolution. Why? Because the progression of life we see on planet Earth continuously seems to anticipate the changes in the physics of the solar system. Now, what you'll notice in Psalm 104, towards the end, that makes the point that it's a property of all life to die off, but that God recreates. He replaces the species of life that goes extinct with new life forms that are better adapted to the changing conditions of the solar system. The mistake that most Darwinists are making, in fact, I haven't seen a single Darwinist address this, is that when we look at the sun, for example, we do not have a constant luminosity pattern for the past 3.8 billion years. For in the early part of those 3.8 billion years, we've got the sun losing luminosity, and it dims by 15%. And for the last 3 billion years, it's been brightening by 15%. Well, you say, how much can light tolerate? Well, at most, it can tolerate a 1% change in the solar luminosity before it's driven to extinction. And so we have here is a planet. And one of the things we notice about planet Earth, throughout those 3.8 billion years, it's been carrying the maximum biomass and the maximum biodiversity. In other words, when we look at the fossil record, we see evidence for at least a half billion different species of life. But the planet can only hold at most 40 or 50 million at any given time. And so, given that it's the purpose of the Creator to have this full spectrum of life forms on the planet, He must distribute them over time. And He distributes them over time to perfectly compensate for the changes in the physics of the sun. What's amazing about planet Earth is over the last 3.8 billion years, it's maintained an ideal temperature on the surface for the survival of life. Meanwhile, the sun is going through these radical changes. But what God does is He removes species of life that are no longer suitable to compensate for the changed luminosity of the sun and replaces them with new species that are. But it's only going to be good for a few million years because the sun continues to brighten or dim. And so every few million years, He needs to remove species that are no longer appropriate and replace them with ones that are appropriate. And it's like, here you've got this Creator who knows the future physics of the solar system and creates life forms to compensate for those changed physical conditions in the solar system. And you say, how does God do this? Well, He creates life forms that will either speed up or slow down the erosion of the Earth's surface. And erosion plays a big role in what happens to the chemistry of the atmosphere. As the sun gets brighter and brighter, He can remove more and more greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. So as the sun gets brighter, He makes Earth's atmosphere less and less efficient to trap heat. And that way you can perfectly compensate for what's going on in the sun. Now in an era when the sun was getting dimmer, what He was doing was pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. One way would be to create a lot of methanogens. Because these bacteria that emit methane, the methane is 10 times more efficient than greenhouse gas and carbon dioxide. So that would be one way to keep the planet warm enough in the situation where you've got a dimming sun, and you can reverse that whole process when the sun starts getting brighter and brighter and then brighter.
Well, if I were to play part of the discussion, devil's advocate, I wouldn't need an extinction event because from what you're describing, the species will die, trilobites will die off anyway, Gorgon will die off anyway as the luminosity goes, and you just have You have a gradual, the original Darwinian model, gradual evolution. You don't need an extinction event every so often.
Yeah, you do if you're, what your future goal is to put human beings on planet Earth with the maximum and highest quality biodeposits at their disposal. What that's going to demand is that you sustain a planet with maximum biomass and biodiversity and optimize ecologies. This is one thing you can see through a study of Job, for example, that when God creates life, he always creates life with optimized ecologies. Now, the Darwinian model would predict that those ecologies would gradually improve over long periods of time. But actually, when we look into the fossil record, we see that the optimized ecologies show up immediately. Now, what that means is, if you want to create new species of life, you've got to remove a whole bunch of species wholesale, basically taking not just species of life off the planet, but an entire ecosystem off the planet, and replacing it with a brand new optimized ecosystem. Now, if what you proposed was appropriate, where you know you got God just replacing the odd species here and there, rather than wholesale extinctions and wholesale mass extinctions, you will not be able to sustain optimized ecologies over the whole face of the Earth throughout the entire time, and you'd wind up delivering to humanity a considerably inferior treasure chest of biodeposits. So again, we need to look at all the different purposes that God has for sustaining life on planet Earth for 3.8 billion years to figure out how he would do it. Now, one of the things you don't see in Peter Ward's analysis is any appropriate discussion of what I call mass speciation events. He looks at the mass extinction events, but he fails to communicate to his readers that there's this mass speciation evidence as well. And what's amazing is how immediate it is. I'll give you two examples. The Triassic dinosaurs, we now know, were wiped out by five big asteroids or comets striking across the North American continent. We can find the crater holes all across northern U.S. and southern Canada. But we can also look through core drills and discover that the Jurassic dinosaurs were fully in place with an optimized ecology just 10,000 years after a total wipeout of the Triassic dinosaurs. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, big animals evolve very, very slowly. So you wipe out all the big animals in the face of the Earth, and 10,000 years later, you've got a whole new system of big animals on the face of the Earth. And if that's not embarrassing, we have two evidences for that. The one that we know the most about is the Cretaceous catastrophe that wiped out the last generation of dinosaurs. Likewise there, we can demonstrate that you get a complete replacement of the ecosystem that was wiped out by a brand new ecosystem, this time dominated by mammals rather than reptiles, again, in less than 10,000 years. Now, no naturalistic model can explain millions of new species showing up with optimized ecologies after a complete wipeout of all the big animals on the face of the Earth. We see it twice. And frankly, I think if we dig a little deeper, we're going to find many examples of that. We were able to do it because we got nice core drill evidence for those two events. But as you know, there's about 10 mass extinction events that have yet to be researched, including the Triassic one. We're just now discovering what was responsible for the Triassic, but to me, that's the most exciting. 95% of all species are wiped out. We do know that the Triassic dinosaurs come about in less than a million years. But maybe if we dig around, we can find it's less than 10,000. It'd be fun to do.
Yeah, thank you.
This is the first time I've ever heard you speak, so I apologize. I'm sure I'm about to ask a question you've been asked 400 times. But since I believe it is not scientifically possible to prove the existence or the non-existence of God, and I assume from as I listen to you speak, your belief is that there is a God that exists, and it's the God referred to in the Christian Bible. I think that's Now, I don't believe you can prove the existence of that God. So I have to ask you, what is your strongest single argument to support that?
Well, when I speak about this in front of university audiences, I often hear the comment that you make, that we can't prove God's existence. And when I hear that from a scholarly audience, my first response is to agree with them. and say, if you're talking absolute proof for the existence of God, you're right. We can't do that. But I follow that up by saying that we cannot do that about anything. I cannot prove the absolute, with absolute proof, the existence of my own wife. I've been married to her for 29 years, but I still lack absolute proof of her existence. And so my response back to the scholarly audience to say, now, if I can give you more evidence scientifically for the existence of the God of the Bible than I can give you for the existence of my wife, will you consider that adequate evidence so that you would then submit your life to the authority of this Creator God? And then I say, would you like to put this to the test? And that's always their big comment. What I'm doing is preempting the next question. Okay, we can come up with practical evidence, but is that really something that we can test in any definitive way? And I say, well, here's how we can test it. What science can do, it can't give you absolute proof, but it can give you probabilities. You know, this is probably correct to this degree of precision, and we'll never reach perfection. But there are certain things like the existence of my wife where the probability is sufficiently high that I'm prepared to continue doing experiments with her. Okay? And in that sense, we can ask the same question of God. As we learn more about the universe and life here on planet Earth, does the evidence scientifically for this Creator God of the Bible get stronger or does it get weaker? If it progressively gets stronger, especially if it gets stronger in a dramatic way as we learn more and more, I would consider that to be better evidence for his existence than the existence of my wife. And therefore, I'd say that's good enough. Now, I run into atheists and say, look, I'm not going to believe anything until I see absolute proof. And I said, I know that's not right. You were here. You wouldn't get up out of your bed in the morning if you weren't acting on practical proof. And therefore, I just simply challenge and be consistent. You make many decisions based on practical proof rather than absolute proof. We need to treat theological matters with the same standard.
Let me sneak a second question in since someone has this. I thought to myself one day that I probably will tell. We may meet one day. I have tried to write down the equation for calculating the probability of existence of God and plug all the terms into it. But,
by the way, we routinely do that at Reasons to Believe. That's what we do. We write these equations with the probabilities.
No, you can use Bayesian probability theory. But I decided to just ask one question. Is there a single prophecy in the Bible which is unique that has ever come true? Now, let me qualify what I mean by unique. The Bible has said there will be floods and famines and fires. Those are general statements that
right.
will always occur if you wait long enough. I do not know of the existence of a single prophecy that is unique in the following way, that it says, on June the 7th, in the year 1783, 12 albino rhinoceri will cross Maine. And what, you know, it's something that is very specific that was predicted centuries or millennia earlier.
Mm-hmm.
If you could just give me one unique prophecy, you would jump my willingness to believe in this God
well,
to the same level you do. You have a unique
yeah.
prophecy.
How about if I give you a scientific one, and then I'll give you an historical one. And by the way, if you challenge me, I could give you at least 200 of each. But let me just give you one, because our time is limited.
I assume you're giving me your best ones.
Well, I'm not sure these are my best ones. But one thing that persuaded me when I was 17 years of age was to read through the Bible and see how frequently it spoke about the universe experiencing continuous expansion from the creation event forward, and how this expansion was a surface effect rather than something that you know, filled the entirety of it. And what I realized is that no book outside the Bible ever taught the continuously expanding universe until Albert Einstein produced his equations of general relativity. I didn't find it in any other holy book. I didn't find any other science book or any book of philosophy. It was unique to the Bible. And the fact that it said it repeatedly, there's 11 places in the Bible where it talks about the continuous expansion of the universe from the creation event forward. How the universe expands like one would unfurl a tent. And the interesting thing about that word picture is the reality of a tent is its surface rather than its interior or its exterior. Likewise, astronomers today know that all of physical reality is on the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional expanding universe. So to me, that's a dramatic statement. No other holy book said that. No other science book said that. This is an example of the Bible thousands of years ahead of its time accurately predicted that cosmic condition. I gave you one earlier where you got Jeremiah 33:25 telling us that the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. Again, that was way beyond the science of its time to say that, say, the four fundamental forces of physics are fixed. That's something we're able to document. We can measure things in the universe 12 billion years back in time, and the same laws of physics that we see today. The fact that the Bible speaks about an actual beginning to space and time. As I looked at the other religious holy books, they're all saying that God creates within space and time. The Bible says God created independent of space and time. Now, let me give you an historical one. And this also was a factor when I was a young man checking out different religions of the world. As I was going through the Bible, and particularly when I got to the book of Ezekiel, I realized, you know, this seems to be specific predictions about the birth of Israel for a second time as a nation. And the passage that particularly caught my attention was Ezekiel 37, where Ezekiel was shown this vision of a valley of dry bones. And he saw all these valleys filled with the skeletons of his people, the Jews. And what Ezekiel was told is that when the nations see these valleys filled with the bones of your people, that's the day when they'll say that the Jewish entity as a nation is finished and will never rise again. Because when the nations say that, that's the time I'll bring about the birth of Israel as a nation. Isaiah actually prophesies the name of that nation. It says the name of the nation will be Israel. And I've documented in a publication I put out a couple of decades ago how there are actually 200 different predictions that are made in the Old Testament concerning what happened from 1948 through to about the 1990s. Some more specifics, this is in the book of Psalms, and it talks about the rebirth of nation as Israel. It says that the nation will be born in intense war with its neighbors. And it actually names the neighbors, gives the names of 10 different Arab peoples that would fight against the birth of this nation. And how Jews coming from other parts of the world with the sentence of death written on their foreheads and their forearms would fight the key battles that would establish this nation of Israel. Well, I mean, I was reading things like that and I said, I got to check this out. So I went to the University of British Columbia Library, went through all the microfiche of these newspapers, the Jerusalem Post, London Times, and San Francisco Chronicle are the ones I really focused on. And what I saw in these newspapers was around late 46 and early 47, you saw in these newspapers these photographs of these valleys in Germany and Poland filled with millions of skeletons of dead Jews. And when those photographs were published, that's when you saw headlines in all these newspapers, Zionism is finished. It will never rise again. Why? Because the heart of the Zionist movement was Poland before World War II. And yet 4 million Polish Jews were wiped out. And as you know, 6.5 million total were wiped out. And they said, Zionism is gone. It will never happen. Yet 1 year later, we see that the nation of Israel is born. And we also notice that there was a big debate in the emerging Knesset as to what to call this nation. And the members of the Knesset were all saying, we've got to call it Zion. Because they were upset about all these newspaper headlines. Zionism is finished, that we're going to call the nation Zion. And then at the last moment, David Ben-Gurion gets up in front of the Knesset and says, we're not taking a vote. We're going to call it Israel. End of discussion. Now, that's remarkable because the Knesset had always taken democratic votes on these issues. One time, they didn't take a vote. They just went along and said, yeah, we're going to call it Israel. And, of course, once the nation was formed, the 10 named nations in the book of Psalms written 3,000 years ago actually took up arms against this new nation, Israel. And who fought the key battles to open up the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem? It was two battalions of Jews that had escaped from Hitler's death camps, and every one of them had the numbers written either on their forearms or their forehead, the sentence of death upon them. And they experienced the greatest loss of life in opening up that road. And David Ben-Gurion stated before the Knesset, if it wasn't for the blood of those sentenced to death, there would be no Israel today. We couldn't have a nation unless we could connect Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And if you read the history of the independent War of Independence, you'll notice that the Haganah tried four times to open up that road and failed every single time. These two battalions that were brand new into Israel, they just got off the boat and they shipped them off to the front with no war experience. Where the Haganah failed, they won and opened up the way. Probably one of the more remarkable ones is Jeremiah 31, 38-40, where it tells us that at the time of the rebirth of the nation of Israel, the city of Jerusalem will prove to be too small for all the Jews coming back from the nations of the world, and actually prophesies in great detail the building of 9 suburbs outside the old city walls. It names the location of each suburb, and it gives the order in which they would be built. Now, I was studying this when I was 18 years of age. As I went through the newspapers, I was able to document that the first 6 suburbs were built in exactly the locations and the order that Jeremiah had predicted. But suburbs 7, 8, and 9 were not yet built. For a very good reason. They were under Arab control. But with the 67 war, they came under Jewish control. Now all 9 suburbs are in place in the locations and the order that Jeremiah had predicted. And to me, what's interesting is that from a purely geographical perspective, suburb 1 is in the worst possible location. But the reason why it was built first, it was the most defensible against Arab attack. And the best suburbs were the last suburbs, but the Jews did not control over them, so they weren't built. So if you want a longer list, I can give you one. But
thank
to
you.
Me, that was impressive.
Being new to this, I don't know what's appropriate. I don't want to hog your time if you had a prepared presentation.
Well, this wasn't I can always talk some other time.
Yes.
So.
This wasn't my question, but just listening to your answer, if I were the devil's advocate, I would say that Ben-Gurion read Jeremiah and said, this is what it says in Jeremiah, so therefore that's what we're going to do. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And I asked that very question when I was reading these newspapers. I said, well, you know, maybe Ben-Gurion's a Bible student. Turns out he wasn't. The founders of the Jewish nation were atheists. They were basically atheist communists, which is why the Russians were so eager to get this nation established. And it's phenomenal. Russia actually cast the vote to set up this nation because they thought for sure it would go communist just like they were. However, the Jews had a very different idea of communism than the Russians had. In fact, the Jews at that time looked at the Russians as not being true communists. I mean, you know, they would have, what they call them, these farms that Jews had where they shared everything. The kibbutz. They said, that's communism. What's going on in the Soviet Union is just, capitalism by a few. And so they said, we're the real communists. And then Russians quickly realized they made a mistake in voting for the establishment of the nation of Israel. It's the one time where Israel and the U.S., or pardon me, Russia and the U.S. both agreed. U.S. and Russia were the first to cast their votes for the forming of this nation. And because they cast their votes, the rest of Europe followed suit and the nation was established.
The early posters that the designers had to attract people to Israel looked like communist workers' posters.
That's right.
Exactly what it was. Anyway, getting back to the question I wanted to ask. Being new to Christianity and listening in church and to others, I've had a lot of questions about what happened to prehistoric peoples. And you can go back through the cave dwellings in France, even archaic human beings that we would have called Heidelbergensis.
Mm-hmm.
And even Neanderthals evidenced some degree of spirituality if the evidence, well, this may be putting ourselves into their place, but they had burials and some evidence of flowers and burials and some evidence of tools for the afterlife and whatever. From a Christian standpoint, what would happen to their ability to gain salvation if they existed tens of thousands or perhaps even 100,000 years before Christ?
Well, it's a very good question. It's a question we address in some detail in this book, Who is Adam?, written by myself and our staff fellow chemist, Fazal Rana. He's speaking tonight elsewhere. But the point we make is that 10, 20 years ago, the amount of evidence we had for these bipedal primate species previous to the human species, if you don't count Neanderthal, you could fit into a small closet. There just wasn't that much evidence. Huge amount of speculation was going on. They now have about 100 complete fossils of Neanderthals. They've recovered DNA from 12 of those fossils. And now they're claiming they've got Y-chromosome DNA evidence that they're going to analyze. So the evidence we have today is considerably more extensive. And that evidence tells us that these so-called Neanderthal burial sites, yeah, you will find a Neanderthal skeleton, actually part of a skeleton, and you'll find pollen and the flower seeds in the same vicinity. But it's in the same vicinity. I mean, we're talking maybe 30 feet away from where the Neanderthal skeleton is found. You know, 20 years ago, they were actually implying that they were finding it right in the bones. And it turns out that's not the case. It's simply in the vicinity. And therefore, that doesn't qualify as evidence that there was some kind of elaborate burial ceremony going on. This just could be accidental placement. It's taking, you know, their guy dies in a cave, for example, where bears come and eat all the Neanderthals. And that's the other thing. There's a lot of speculation that Neanderthals were engaged in bear idol worship. And then now they believe what happened is that the bears decided to take over the Neanderthal cave, and that explains the bear evidence along with the Neanderthal evidence. It wasn't Neanderthals ruling these bears in any sophisticated way. They probably lost the battle. Bears wanted the cave, and they were stronger. They took over. And in terms of tools, the most, in terms of undisputed evidence for Neanderthal tool use, the best they've come up with is that Neanderthals were using a hammer rock to break a core rock. In other words, they would put a rock on the ground, take a second rock, smash that second rock against the first rock, and get it to shatter, and they would pick up the flakes and use the flakes for whatever they could use. There was no shaping of the tools. They weren't building hammers and shovels. There was no fish hooks, no needles which they could sew closed. And this is the other thing that I think has turned things around in the anthropological community. As 10 years ago, they were speculating that Neanderthals wore clothes like we do. Well, one thing we know about Neanderthals, they were much better adapted to a cold climate than we are. They were shorter, much stockier, shorter arms and shorter legs, barrel chest, and they had this nasal capacity that was really large. In fact, it's the largest nasal capacity compared to body size of any mammal, period. Which has caused some anthropologists to say we can't tell where Neanderthal evolved from because there's no way they could have gotten this nasal capacity from any other species of life. But that's what makes it very well adapted to a cold climate. I mean, I grew up in Canada. When you go up far enough north, the only way you can survive in winter is to wear one of these special parkas where the hood goes way out like this. And the whole idea is that as you breathe air in, there's a chance to be warmed up before it gets to your nose. Well, the Neanderthals had that by nature. They had this enormous nasal capacity, which allowed this cold air they were breathing in to get warmed up before it hit the lungs. And I can tell you from personal experience, if you don't wear that hood at 40 below, you're going to burn your lungs. You've got to take special protection. Now, I say all that by way of background because about 3 years ago, they discovered that there's a period of time when humans and Neanderthals overlapped. Humans have been around for about 50,000 years, and Neanderthals persist to about 35,000 to 38,000 years. Well, during that period of overlap, they document that humans were living in a climate zone. Some humans were living in a climate zone 10 to 15 degrees colder than the coldest climate zone that Neanderthal was living in. Now, what's the difference? We wore clothes. They did not. We had clothing technology. They did not. And there is no evidence in any of these Neanderthal finds of clothing items along with them.
Okay, well, let's move beyond Heidelbergensis and Neanderthal and talk about the elephants, you say, anatomically modern humans, 50,000 to 25,000 years ago. What happens to them spiritually? What happens to their ability to gain self-image?
Okay, my point is this. There there is no evidence for Neanderthal spiritual activity. There's no evidence that Homo erectus had any spiritual activity. It's unique to human beings. What we document in this book, we have a whole chapter devoted to what we call the cultural big bangs. How as soon as human beings show up, Homo sapiens sapiens, as compared to archaic Homo sapiens, which are basically tropical Neanderthals. They have different morphology because now they're being adapted for a warm climate instead of a cold climate. They are different species. They're not human. When humans show up 50,000 years ago, you see this immediate big bang of advanced tools. As soon as humans are there, you get fish hooks with barbs. You get needles with eyes in them. You get tools that have multiple appendages, like a wooden handle with sinews holding a stone axe head. What is particularly remarkable is you see carved ivory and the very sophisticated tools. None of that exists for the Neanderthals or Homo erectus. Although there's one case that's controversial where they have found some of these advanced tools in the same vicinity as Neanderthal bones. However, it's during that period of overlap. There's nothing previous to the period of overlap. And the thing we observe with advanced primates that share the planet with us, they love to steal our tools. And the fact that there's only a few tools in these finds, and that they're in the same place where they get human remains, leads researchers to conclude that the Neanderthals were stealing the tools, but they didn't know how to use them. You'll see monkeys, for example, running around Japan, where each one of them is holding a Coke can. I've seen that personally. Now, hundreds of monkeys going across the freeway, and each one of them's got a Coke can in its hand. And they will not let go of that Coke can. I mean, even they're in danger of being run over, they still hang on to that Coke can. And they're not using it for anything, they just hang on to it. So, but that's kind of the way primates are. I mean, if any of you have ever had a monkey in your home, they will steal anything you've got. But if you look around, you'll find the stolen items in different places in your yard and so forth. You can recover them because you don't know how to use them. So it looks like that's all we see for the Neanderthals is the stealing of human artifacts, if that. It could simply be that the two humans and Neanderthals were in the same vicinity, and what we thought were Neanderthal implements were simply human implements that were left there too, because we do see overlap. The whole point is there's zero undisputed evidence that Neanderthals ever engaged in advanced culture. No advanced art, no advanced music, no language expression. And the other thing that's particularly remarkable is jewelry. With human beings, we see an immediate burst of jewelry coming upon the scene, jewelry that serves no other purpose. Whereas with Neanderthals, no jewelry at all. Homo erectus, no jewelry. Humans, anything about the first humans, the jewelry outweighs the tools by about 10 to 1. I think that's also true today. So,
but spiritually, what happened to the undisputed, the anatomical?
Well, the same thing that would happen to a dog. You know, a dog is not a spiritual being. When a dog dies, it goes to the dust. That's what Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes. It's only the spirit creature that lives beyond this physical life. It's the spirit within the human being that is eternal. The body is temporal, but the spirit is eternal. However, the soulish animals, these are the advanced animals, birds and mammals, and Genesis 1 tells us that God creates three kinds of animals. Animals that are purely physical, animals that are physical and soulish, and it defines that as a creature that's endowed with mind, will, and emotions, so that that creature can form an emotional bond with human beings. And birds and mammals have that capacity. Cockroaches don't. But there's only one species, according to Genesis, that God has created, that is body, soul, and spirit. That's one reason why we're referred to as being the image of God. Because God is body, soul, and spirit, so that we, body, soul, and spirit, as God is eternal, we too are eternal once we're created by God.
Yeah, perhaps I'm not phrasing the question, and I apologize for that, but I'm speaking in terms of Homo sapiens sapiens who might have lived 10 or 15 or 20
years. Different question. Okay. What about this primitive Homo sapiens sapiens who died long before Moses,
right,
and Jesus and Jeremiah, St. Paul, all the rest of that? The Bible addresses that question. You'll see it in Romans 2. where it says that God has put his law on the heart of every human being, the conscience. Hence, every human being's got the same conscience. Which really explains why all the religions of the world have the same basic moral law. God wrote that law in our hearts, it says. And because he's written that law, we're told in Romans 1 that each of us is held accountable before God. None of us can say we didn't have evidence of God. In fact, the next few weeks in the class I teach on Sunday mornings, I'm going to take the class through what I call the Gospel According to Job. And we're simply going to pull verses out of the book of Job, which shows you that Job and his friends understood all the elements of the pathway into coming into a right relationship with the Creator without any written scripture at all. And where did they draw their evidence from? Exclusively from the record of nature. Which is why it tells us in Colossians and Romans 1 and Habakkuk and the book of Acts that everyone has heard. We've all heard the gospel message. The problem is our human pride prevents us from seeing what's been obviously revealed, which is why God chose to give us a Bible and chose to send out people to spread the message of how we can receive salvation. But it's abundantly clear through nature itself. And we have evidence that it's abundantly clear because in the Old Testament times, people did respond fully to that gospel message for the benefit of written scripture. And you say, well, how come they didn't have the written scripture and we do? Well, I think God measures out revelation in direct proportion to human pride. I think one reason why we in the 21st century have so much more evidence through astrophysics and biochemistry and everything else is the fact that this is the most prideful generation that's ever lived. And therefore, God cuts through that extra measure of pride with extra revelation. When I read the story of Job and Elihu, I see men that are incredibly humble. And it's that humility that allowed them to see that which we can't see in the 21st century. So that's what we're lacking.
Thank you.
How would you explain the following? The God of the Christian Bible says, suffer the little children to come unto me, presumably has love and mercy. And so your neighbor's 2-year-old daughter is crawling across her driveway, it slopes, and his pickup truck, an emergency brake accidentally, comes loose, and the truck backs over and cripples itself a lot. Why did God allow that to happen?
Well, that's a question that Jesus addresses in the Gospels. Because he was asked that question all the time. You'll see an account where he says, well, you know, what about all those killed when the tower of Siloam fell? And he says, well, they did not get killed because they were more evil than the rest of you. This is part of the laws of physics under which we live. And what you notice is that occasionally God will intervene to save us from the laws of physics. But it tells us in Hebrews 12 that God has placed us here on planet Earth to be disciplined. And a large measure of that discipline is the laws of physics. And if God intervened to save every single child that was in danger of death, then those laws of physics would serve no import in restraining us from committing evil and bringing about the conquest of evil. This is the theme of a new book I just got off to our editors. Is how one of the major reasons for God setting up the physics of the universe is to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. And for that physics to be effective, it's critical that God intervene only a few times. Now, that does not mean that God controls the death of young ones for his benefit. This is a theme brought up in Isaiah 58, that God will sometimes visit death on the young as a way to achieve his purpose. And there's a number of ways he does that. What it says in Isaiah 58 is that God sees a young person and recognizes that the future for that young person is filled with trouble. He will save that young person from trouble by bringing that young person home early. Now, the context for all this is God tells us that this life we have here on planet Earth is short by any context. None of us are going to make it past much more than 120 years. That's kind of a biological maximum. So whether you live 2 years or 120 years, it's still a very short period of time. If you compare it to how old the universe is, it's just a wisp of time. And we're told that. We're also told that the time we spend here on planet Earth is designed to prepare us for a life beyond. Now, some don't need as much time to get prepared. Others do need more time to get prepared. God gives each of us different times. It tells us in Psalms that when you're born, God already has the day marked out in the calendar of your death. He knows exactly how many days you're going to live. And He picks that number of days to make sure you get the best score in the test of life possible. Now, that works both for the righteous and the wicked. In the case of the wicked, God tries to structure your lifespan in such a way as to minimize the torment you'll experience in the lake of fire. He does not want to visit any more torment upon you than is necessary. So in some cases, He will extend the life of the wicked in order to give them opportunities to limit that wickedness in their life, or sometimes He will shorten it.
You could test your hypothesis, maybe. You know, I mean, I'm always a little bothered when an airplane crashes and some people survive and a lot of people live, the will of God that those people survive, and the plane that crashes the next day and everybody's killed. So now God doesn't get blamed for that. He gets the credit for the ones that survive. But, you know, things happen stochastically, statistically.
Right.
If you gather data and use statistics to predict having the little girls of age 2, etc., and you found out that you weren't getting within a margin of tolerance of your statistical prediction, you might argue that there is a power intervening. And I don't know if anybody's ever attempted to do that, to see if, in fact, the occurrence of certain events are unnatural as based upon statistical prediction. You understand that?
I understand your question, and I could give you an anecdotal response in the lives of certain individuals where they would have no doubt that God was pulling the strings behind the scenes because it was simply stochastic physics. There's really no way to explain what happened. But I would argue God does not do that for every human being in the face of the earth. He has a purpose in the stochastic physics. It's critical that God have built in an uncertainty in the quantum world, for example. And what I see in looking at the physics of quantum uncertainty, the level of the uncertainty is incredibly fine-tuned to make life as ideal as possible for human beings. If the uncertainty was less, or the uncertainty was more, we would have great trouble. Likewise, statistical mechanics. I took a course in statistical mechanics and just the random motion of the atoms through the atmosphere and through the Earth. What I recognize is the way that Brownian movement operates, again, is incredibly fine-tuned to make life ideal. In other words, God's got a vested purpose in letting the laws of probability operate, and Jesus Himself has said that He and His Father would only intervene to interrupt those stochastic physics on rare occasions to bring about a particular spiritual point. Otherwise, He lets the laws of physics run. However, that in no way negates the fact that God controls every moment in your life. This, again, is part of the paradox. How does God predetermine every event in your life, yet at the same time allow stochastic physics to operate and allows your free will to set the course of your life? Now, those seem like contradictions, but my point is they're only contradictions if you try to solve the problem in the context of length, width, height, and time.
Okay. No one's behind me. I'm going to speak another quick question. Do you believe that God responds to prayer?
I do believe that God responds to prayer, but I also recognize that the promise we got from Jesus is any prayer we ask according to the will of the Creator will be answered according to that will. And so what I'm required to do as a Christian in my prayer life is rather than talk at God, in my speaking with God to make sure I'm listening. Because my job as a Christian is to hear God's voice to me. And as I pray according to the Lord's will, it will be done. I can count on it as a guarantee. But my struggle is to try to separate the will of God in my life from my own sinful desires. And that's why I believe we're called to pray. Now, praying is an opportunity to hear God's voice, not simply go to God with a list of demands. I want this, I want this. You know, it's kind of like a little child going to Santa Claus.
No, I know. And are you aware of the recent studies that have been completed where several hundred people, well, they had, I guess they had 1,200 people that had been through open heart bypass surgery.
Right.
And what they wanted to look for is the healing rate following the surgery and the complications.
I'm aware of those studies.
And so they had a number of people pray, well, let's say 600 of the 12, that they have a speeding problem for your recovery.
Right.
And you know the outcome of that was that if anything, the group not prayed for is better.
Well, the truth is these kinds of studies have been done for about 40 years, and you get mixed results. Now, the study you're referring to, I read the report, and what makes it problematic, at least from a Christian perspective, they made no attempt to isolate the different religious groups. So they put Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims, Christadelphians, Jehovah's Witnesses, evangelicals were a very tiny minority in all that. Now, from a Christian perspective, we would expect that it would produce zero results. Now, I've seen other studies where they exclusively select out the evangelicals to prayer, and they don't give them a general prayer. They encourage the people to pray as specifically as possible for that individual to get to know that individual. Now, if you do just kind of a blind test where you have no idea who you're praying for, and you simply say, God, make them well. Well, what I tell people in this church is, when you pray like that, here's God's answer. Okay, how do you want me to make them well? And God is asking us to work with Him to see exactly what He wants to do in that person's life. In fact, what it tells us in James, if you're ill and need physical healing, call upon the elders of the church and have them pray for you. But before you have them pray for you, get together with them and confess your sins in front of them. Now, if you read that in the original Greek, what it really tells us is that when you go before the church elders, you want to go before elders that know you personally, for whom you accept their authority over your life, and you give them permission to expose hidden sin in your life. And the promise is that sin is exposed in your life, and you repent of that sin, you'll not only experience a spiritual healing, but a physical healing. Now, we practice that in this church. But one of the things we discovered early on is that it wasn't a good idea to make public the healings that were being experienced. So we told the people that came to us for praying, this is confidential. We're not going to tell anybody about what's going on here. Now, if you care to tell people, that's fine. But we as elders aren't going to say a word. It's like a medical thing. It's just between us. And if you're serious about getting this physical healing, will you give us the right to allow the Holy Spirit to work through us to expose evil and sin in your life that you may not even know about or your family members may not know about? Now, I also share with people like that, I don't think you should ask for this kind of prayer unless you can really trust us with your life. If you don't know us, it's probably not a good idea for you to be here asking for this kind of prayer. But if you know us, and we know you, and you trust us, then we will pray. Now, I can tell you, one of the pastors here at the church, I've seen phenomenal physical healings.